It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. Team Fox, a clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It's Thursday, March 28th, 2024. I'm Guy Benson. Welcome to the Guy Benson Show from Washington, D.C. Very happy to have you listening wherever you might be between 3 and 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's every weekday. Then, of course, another option is the podcast around the clock for free on demand when the show is over. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm the political editor at townhall.com. I'm a Fox News contributor. Hope to see you on Special Report tonight. I'll be on the panel around 6:40, 6:45 Eastern time with Brett Baier and company. So set your DVRs or tune in live. Here on the radio, we'll get to our first guest in just a moment. Paul Morrow, retired NYPD. He will join us in our next hour. Byron York also here in our final hour. But we begin today's show with former U.S. Secretary of State, former CIA director, former Congressman Mike Pompeo. He's a Fox News contributor and author of the book Never Give an Inch. Mr. Secretary, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Guy, it's great to be with you this afternoon.
I want to ask you, today is the one-year anniversary of Russia's wrongful detainment of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich. He has been behind bars, wrongly accused of espionage for 365 days. I know a lot of people have been pushing to have him released. I shudder to think what it might take to get him released in terms of some kind of a swap, which would be deeply unbalanced. He was just a journalist doing his job. As someone who led the U.S. foreign policy team for years under President Trump, what would your approach be to getting this journalist home?
And these are always incredibly tough situations, and Susan and I pray for Evan and for his family. These are difficult times for them. These hostage issues are as gut-wrenching a thing as one works on when you're the Secretary of State, for sure. And a second thing is, it's important for us all to just reiterate, you did. This is a civilian. This is not someone, as the Kremlin tells us, that is a spy conducting espionage. He was doing his job. He was a journalist. And so, indeed, his being held is deeply immoral. Our approach was always to think about what were the tools of power that someone like Vladimir Putin might understand. What might be the things that we could convince them that the United States was prepared to do in order to get this fellow back? And we didn't pay for folks to come back, guys. Just we found that to be counterproductive. They just take more hostages. The lineup would just get bigger. But there were lots of things. Some of them quiet. Some of them out of the public light, that you can do to convince Vladimir Putin that the cost of holding him exceeds the benefit. And I don't want to go into too much detail about them, but suffice to say, I can tell you there were a whole handful of times during our 4 years that it actually worked very quietly, very decently. We got Pastor Brunson back. We got the three hostages out of North Korea that I was able to bring back with me on my second trip. It is possible to do if you are resolved and you make clear your expectations to your adversary.
Do you believe Evan will be coming home? Will they free him at some point here?
I do. I believe that day will come. Sadly, we're 365 days too late now. But yes, I believe that someday we will be able to convince, the United States will be able to convince Vladimir Putin that holding him isn't worth the candle. And I hope that's what President Biden is trying to do. They're often looking for like the who can they trade? How can they do that? It's a bit of a fool's game, as you can see, right? We got Brittany Griner back, right. But they just take more hostages. And so there are better ways. There are better tools by which to convince your adversaries not to do these kind of things, not to be hostile towards Americans. Hard stuff for sure. The Israelis are seeing the same phenomenon, right? They've now got dozens of folks being held in Gaza, some of them Americans. These hostage issues are complex and difficult and always fraught, Guy.
I was going to move to Israel next, so let's go there. I was genuinely surprised, and I hold this administration in pretty low esteem on a number of fronts, but I was still a bit stunned by the vote this week at the United Nations, the abstention by the United States allowing this Israel-opposed, flawed so-called ceasefire resolution to pass. The Israelis, of course, are very upset that that happened. President Biden had summoned a new delegation to Washington to discuss the Rafah question, trying to convince Israel not to do what must be done in Rafah. Now that delegation has been postponed, delayed, or just canceled because of this diplomatic flare-up, where there is now quite a lot of daylight between the Israelis and the United States of America. And the context for this, as you know, Mr. Secretary, is October 7th, this existential war, these savages in Hamas, the hostages still there, including, as you point out, Americans. I just wonder what your reaction is to Biden policy vis-a-vis Israel, what happened at the United Nations this week, and where we can go from here.
I find that policies they've chosen to be personally abhorrent, Guy, and as a policy matter, dangerous for the United States of America. So, you know, we can go through the list. You began with this week. We allowed, that is, with American consent, we demanded that Israel conduct a ceasefire without even asking for the hostages to be returned. And we put literally no burden on the terrorists, on Hamas, underwritten by Iran. So we unilaterally sided with Hamas against the nation of Israel. That is indecent. It's inconsistent with 5 decades plus of American history with Israel. And it fits the model, frankly, from the Biden administration. They began by calling Crown Prince in the Middle East a pariah, and by de-designating the Houthis as terrorists who are now launching missiles to take out ships in the Strait. And they negotiated to put Iran back in a nuclear deal with the Iranians. So they've had a long history of coddling these terrorists, and you can see the results. Now, dozens of hostages held, more than hundreds of Israelis brutalized on October 7th, and no indication that Hamas or Hezbollah or the Houthis have any reason to fear the United States or Israel's retaliation, because we have not demonstrated the resolve that is necessary.
Mr. Secretary, on another front, there was an interview given by the president of Mexico to 60 Minutes. It aired just recently, and he had a lot to say. He really went off, AMLO, as they call him. And he has a series of proposals slash demands for the United States of America. I want you to just listen to Cut 26. In some ways, it's pretty breathtaking. Listen here.
With the ear of the White House, President Lopez Obrador proposed his fix, that the United States commit $20 billion a year to poor countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, lift sanctions on Venezuela, end the Cuban embargo, and legalize millions of law-abiding Mexicans living in the U.S.
If they don't do the things that you've said need to be done, then what?
The flow of migrants will continue.
So the president of Mexico to our south says this massive, frankly, invasion of the United States will continue unless the United States agrees to pay $20 billion annually to certain countries, including, I'd imagine, his own, to end the sanctions on Venezuela, to end the embargo against Cuba. Those are both communist regimes, and also a mass amnesty of millions of Mexicans in the United States as well. If AMLO or anyone else came to the negotiating table or went on national television under, let's say, President Trump with those requests, what would the response be?
You know, it's hard to even countenance that some set of requests like that would be made of President Trump or our administration. The conversations were just radically different. You remember, it is AMLO who ultimately, and against his initial desires, it was AMLO who agrees to remain in Mexico. So one president, one secretary of state were able to convince the president of Mexico to allow folks who declared asylum in the United States to return to Mexico and stay there indefinitely. And with a different president, he's making these ridiculous, ludicrous demands that you just described. look, if he presented us, we'd say, yeah, well, nice try. That's not what we're going to do. And we would begin to impose real costs on him and his government for not doing their part to ensure that we didn't have these massive number of migrants invading our country, not just Mexican migrants, but people transiting from third countries through Mexico, along with the drugs they take with them. We had a model that demonstrated that we were going to preserve our southern border sovereignty, and President Biden has clearly signaled he has no interest in doing that. And you get precisely this guy, right? Once the floodgates have opened, why not, in addition to being able to have these migrants move through, why not ask for money in support of it? It seems like maybe the President Biden would agree to that.
Since you invoked Remain in Mexico, I was not in the room. You were, at least to a large extent, when those policies were hammered out, very successful policies toward the back half of the Trump administration, really got the border not fully under control, but dramatically under control. Nothing close to the chaos that we've seen for the last 3+ years. AMLO is a lefty. He is a very proud man, obviously. He can make sort of galling statements like the one we just heard that we just played. I can't imagine that he just readily, happily agreed to the Remain in Mexico policy once it was suggested by President Trump and the team. To the extent that you're able to talk to us about this, how was pressure brought to bear to have this exact same leader agree to that policy that seems almost unfathomable right now?
Yes, Guy, it's absolutely true. Neither he nor my counterpart at the time, Marcelo Ebrard, who was the then Mexican foreign minister, neither of them thought this could be done. Foreign Minister Ebrard and I had been talking about this for weeks and weeks and weeks. And in the end, the president said, look, if he won't agree to it, then we're going to impose real costs on him. Think about entirely closing the border and a handful of other things. And we went down, we explained, hey, here's the option. If we don't see a substantial reduction in migrant flow, we don't see you putting Mexican National Guard both at the American southern border to stop them there and at your southern border, at the border between Mexico and Guatemala, then we're going to take draconian measures that are going to impose real costs on you. And it was sufficiently credible. This is the important part of it. It was sufficiently credible because it was President Trump that I think he understood we were prepared to actually execute that. And it became clear to him it was in his best interest to participate in the effort to ensure that these folks didn't travel across our border. It's that clear. You know this guy, deterrence is never permanent, and it is never easy. And you have to be willing to impose costs on your counterparty, or you're not going to deter them from doing the things that they're doing. And President Trump was very good about that. If we drew a red line, we honored it. That means, you know, you don't draw a whole lot of red lines, but when we did draw a red line, we honored it. And sadly, the Biden administration is just unprepared to do anything to impose costs on on AMLO for doing precisely what it is he just described. When AMLO says, hey, those drugs that have continued to flow across my border because you all have a demand problem on your side, he's partially speaking the truth, but he is partially abdicating his responsibility in that. And when I think of the jihadists, the cartels that sit on our other on the Mexican side of our border as well, he has a responsibility to contain that lawlessness that flows into our country. And if he doesn't, we have not only the right but the duty to go get them and make sure that they don't continue to present risk to the United States of America.
Well, it feels like deterrence is dead right now down there. And based on the comments that he made and the tone of the comments, he's just walking all over the current administration. That's at least his read of the situation. Unfortunately, it seems like the correct read. Last question, Mr. Secretary. It's a political one. I'm just going to put it out there because there's been a lot of discussion, as there always is, around this sort of thing. Who is Donald Trump going to select as his running mate for this upcoming election in November? And the conventional wisdom holds that he's probably going to pick a woman or maybe someone of color and diversify the ticket or what have you. I'm not sure that's the type of calculation that he makes. And I just keep coming back occasionally to another name, someone who would be ready to be president on day one, someone who served in Congress, someone who was a top-level cabinet secretary who maintains a good relationship with the former president. Let's just say that phone call came in for you to get vetted or at least entertain that type of question. Would you be open to it?
Guy, that's quite a preamble there. But I'll answer the question as best I can. I don't often talk about opportunities I've not been offered, but My life has been one where I've been incredibly blessed to be an American. If I got a chance to serve and the president wanted me to serve and I thought I could make a difference, I'm almost certain that I would say yes to a request like that. If I thought I could literally help the president be successful in whatever role that might be, I'd be pretty inclined to go try and be part of the team to actually deliver good outcomes for the country.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, my guest on the Guy Benson Show. Mr. Secretary, we covered a lot of ground here. We really appreciate you opening up the broadcast with us today.
Thank you. God bless you. Have a happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you as well. And with that, let's step aside, take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective.
The Guy Benson Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
I'm Guy Benson. We're back. Really interesting, newsy interview there with former Secretary Mike Pompeo. I didn't really want to put him too much on the spot with the VP question. I just been thinking about it and just his resume. I would feel very comfortable with that man as vice president or president, if necessary, of the United States. And you think about who we've got now in that position. Kamala Harris, our border czar. You just heard Mike Pompeo talk about the border, talk about that crisis, talk about illegal immigration, talk about using the levers of American power to pressure the Mexican government, for example. And then you compare that with this crew. Harris just gave a few remarks this week saying that her whole root causes crusade is actually working. Cut 21.
For the past 3 years, I have led our administration's efforts to address the root causes of migration from Northern Central America and to create what we have named the Root Causes Strategy. This work is improving lives and livelihoods in the region and addressing the factors that drive people to migrate to the United States.
Yeah, the old Root Causes Strategy. Improving lives and livelihoods. Is that so? I'd ask if she'd been to the border recently, but we know the answer to that question. It's no. She went once for this very sanitized visit in a non-hot spot at the time. And that's it. Now, don't call me the border czar. I'm the root causes strategy coordinator or whatever. 10 million illegal crossings approximately. Almost 2 million known gotaways. In no way, shape, or form is the root causes strategy working, especially with the cavalier, brazen attitude of the Mexicans, as we heard from AMLO in the soundbite that we played in the last segment. The message is out that people can come here illegally and stay here, and for millions, that is true. The people who might help us stop it don't respect us, don't respect this team. The numbers speak for themselves. And the woman supposedly in charge of this and the vice president one heartbeat away from the presidency seems to think it's working, which just takes your breath away. How well is it working? A few more examples in response to that when we come back. It's the Guy Benson Show.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
We're back on the Guy Benson Show. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free. So Kamala Harris, the vice president and border czar, seems to think that the root causes strategy is working. We just had the worst February on record on encounters at the southern border. The worst February ever. And this is despite some of the real changes, successful ones being made in Texas. The cartels are moving the flow to the blue states to the west. New Mexico, Arizona, California. 2.4 million illegal crossings last year alone. Roughly 10 million total illegal crossings on Joe Biden's watch. Worst February ever, as I just said. Roughly 2 million known gotaways. Who knows what threats lurk in those gotaways who, by the way, pay the cartels more money to not get caught. For a lot of people, the goal is to get apprehended and then quote-unquote documented, processed, and released. You can basically stay. Unless you murder someone, basically, you can stay. That's the message. That's the policy, effectively, of the Biden administration. And she's boasting. She's boasting about the root causes and the great work they're doing there. It's unbelievable. Meanwhile, the steady drumbeat of horrible crimes being committed by illegal immigrants continues. And as I always say, these stories are not a reflection on immigrants broadly or even illegal immigrants broadly. But it is extra intolerable when someone in this country, an American, is harmed, assaulted, brutalized, raped, or murdered by someone who does not have a right to be here in the first place. It is rational to be more indignant and angry over those crimes because they are crimes that should have never happened. They should have never been given the opportunity, these suspects, to commit the crimes because they shouldn't be here. So it's not a broad smear of immigrants or illegal immigrants, but it is highlighting that this is not just a national sovereignty concern, a law and order concern, thinking about the spitting in the eye of all the people who are trying to go about this the correct way, the legal way, and all the many, many millions who have done so in the past. What chumps. It is also a national security and a public safety concern as well. And it's not like we're just focusing on Lake and Riley in Georgia and that's it. She is one of a growing list of names that the Trump campaign is calling the Biden bloodbath because of these border policies. Here's the latest example just from yesterday, a story in the New York Post. Illegal immigrant charged in Michigan woman's killing was deported under Trump but snuck back in, according to ICE. The illegal immigrant accused of shooting dead a 25-year-old Michigan woman. I'm looking at her photo. Here's a woman in a sweatshirt with Mother Earth on it, big smile, looks like she's outdoors somewhere, 25, early in her life, dead. Why? Because she was shot dead during a botched carjacking, and the person who shot her, according to authorities, had been deported during the Trump administration, but subsequently slipped back into the United States through that border that they tell us is closed and secure. They still actually say that. Closed and secure. Do not come. Oh, they're coming, and in some cases, they're doing things like this. The accused killer here is a Mexican national, also 25. This person has allegedly confessed to repeatedly shooting the victim, Ruby Garcia, a woman of color, during an argument late Friday, including once after he got out of her car to make sure she was dead. A final kill shot just to make sure she wouldn't survive. He already had a criminal history in Michigan dating back to 2017. Was arrested on a bench warrant after failing to show up in court for other violations back in 2020. Trump and the Trump administration deported him. And then, at some unknown date, this man re-entered the United States, apparently a known gotaway, because he did not get stopped. He was not processed. He was one of those, in all likelihood, roughly 2 million gotaways during Joe Biden. Made his way back to Michigan and now has confessed to murdering a 25-year-old woman while he was allegedly drunkenly trying to steal her car. This is a life that should not have been cut short. Oh, it's xenophobic and racist to talk about this. No, it's not. The woman he killed is Hispanic. Does her life matter, or do we just care about the sensibilities of the criminals? We had the president recently apologize for using the word illegal. He would never disrespect someone like this. Never, ever, by calling them illegal. Well, guess what? This was an illegal immigrant with a criminal history who was deported, came back in the country without being detected, and now murdered a young woman. How's that? Here's another one. That's Michigan. This is Alabama. Also from the New York Post. An illegal immigrant has been arrested for allegedly raping a mentally incapacitated 14-year-old girl in Alabama, prompting the state senator to rip President Biden for aiding and abetting these monsters. The suspect here is 23 years old. It's unclear what his nation of origin is, but he is here illegally, according to officials. And the girl that he allegedly raped, 14, could not consent, A, because she's 14, B, because she is, quote, physically helpless or mentally incapacitated, according to news outlets. And by the way, this is not to be confused with the disabled girl who was raped allegedly in Massachusetts recently by an illegal immigrant, a Haitian national paroled into the United States under Joe Biden's specific policies. In fact, he was flown to the United States, to New York, JFK Airport. He was supposed to be in New Jersey with his sponsor. Instead, somehow he ended up in a migrant shelter in Massachusetts where that man allegedly raped a disabled young woman. That is a different story than this one from Alabama. I know maybe it's hard to keep them all straight. We were just telling you about that other instance. What was it, last week? The Democrat governor of Massachusetts responded by saying, oh, yes, it's a terrible thing, but we have the right processes in place. Really, does it feel that way? Governor Healey, relatively okay about it. The processes are in place. Maybe she had a little kumbaya phone call with the vice president and border czar who said, hey, root causes, that's working. We're improving lives. Whose lives exactly are we improving, I wonder? A few more points, because part of the reason that Trump and the Trump administration, this was, I think, really well stated by Mike Pompeo at the top of the show here, part of the reason they got this thing under control in 2018, 2019, then, of course, 2020, and the pandemic hit, but they vastly improved the situation at the border and secured the border in the last administration because of a number of policies. I would say the number one successful one of which was Remain in Mexico, which Joe Biden got into office and ripped it up on day one. And wouldn't you know it, the border crisis exploded immediately. Trump had done something. It didn't matter if it was good, didn't matter if it was working, didn't matter if it was a hard-fought diplomatic victory against an administration in Mexico that didn't want to really help but was compelled to. That did not matter. What mattered was it had Trump's name on it, so Biden threw it in the garbage, and the result is the worst border crisis in American history by far. And now you've got the Mexican president so emboldened that he's going on American national television and making a bunch of demands. Let's play that clip again. Cut 26, 60 minutes. Here's how they describe what the president of Mexico is telling Biden we have to do in this country.
With the ear of the White House, President López Obrador proposed his fix, that the United States commit $20 billion a year to poor countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, lift sanctions on Venezuela, end the Cuban embargo, and legalize millions of law-abiding Mexicans living in the U.S. If they don't do the things that you've said need to be done, then what?
The flow of migrants will continue.
That's blackmail. That's a threat. All right, listen here, Joe. You're going to give us $20 billion a year in Latin America. You're going to start helping communist regimes in Caracas and in Havana. You're going to end those sanctions and those policies, right? The embargo. Oh, and you're also going to do a mass amnesty of millions of people. And if you don't, then tough luck. That border problem you've got is going to just keep going and maybe get worse. That is how shameless the president of Mexico is feeling right now. to say that openly, out loud, on American national television, making demands of this government and this president. And part of me really does worry that the response from Biden, rather than a two-word response that I can't say on the radio, would be, well, golly gee, I wonder what our left-wing activists think of this. Do they like it? Can we focus group these people? What do the Hamas fans think of this? Maybe we should do it. This, the weakness is incredible. There's also this, by the way. I saw this quote from the Mexican president. This guy's really running his mouth off, isn't he? In the interview, he said that the bridge collapse in Baltimore shows that migrants in the United States, quote, do not deserve to be treated as they are. Well, that's an insane thing to say. I know that there were some Mexican nationals, tragically, who were killed in this accident. And the Mexican president's response is, oh, yeah, this shows what a terrible place, what an awful place it is in the United States, the way migrants are treated. What? This giant ship lost power. They couldn't steer it. It crashed into a bridge. And some laborers were horribly, tragically killed. That has nothing to do with how migrants are treated in the United States. But he just decided, oh, here's a tragedy. Here's video footage that looks bad. Let's figure out a way to dunk on the United States somehow, publicly, and make it somehow a criticism of our country, where migrants are the victims of maltreatment or something? What the hell is he talking about? This is someone who needs to be put in his place. And that is not going to happen with the president of the United States, the current one. It's not. What the hell is he talking about? The bridge collapse accident shows migrants, quote, do not deserve to be treated as they are? What? And by the way, if things were so terrible and unimaginable for migrants in the United States, why do 10 million of them want to come here illegally? Why have they done so? Why wouldn't they stay in Mexico? Why wouldn't remain in Mexico be the voluntary policy of these people? If it's so horrible here, you'd think people would just want to be in Mexico. Well, first of all, the Mexicans don't want them there. The Mexicans have tough enforcement of their own laws. But they're playing these games with us, making demands of us, blaming America broadly for this freak accident. Just a very strange thing to say. This guy's feeling his oats. Feel like with another president, a different president, the phone might ring in Mexico City. Like, hey, AMLO, let's have a word. Stop flapping your gums. Let's remember how this relationship actually goes. That phone call is not going to be placed by Joe Biden. You know it, and I know it. Let's talk about another juxtaposition between the current president and, for the purpose of this discussion, the previous president, playing out today in New York City. I'll explain when we come back. It's the Guy Benson Show.
America is listening to the Guy Benson Show.
Welcome back to the Guy Benson Show. The current president and his predecessor are both in New York today. They're there for very different reasons. Former President Donald Trump is attending the wake of a man named Jonathan Diller. We'll get into his story in much more detail in the next hour with Paul Morrow, an NYPD inspector retired. Jonathan Diller was an NYPD officer. He was shot to death in the line of duty. His killer had been arrested 21 times previously and just out on the street. Thank you, New York Democrats. Let's just call a spade a spade. So much justice, so much progress, so much equity. Young family man gone. NYPD officer slain by a man who had been arrested over and over and over and over again. Donald Trump is attending the wake. He spoke to the family. This is like Lake and Riley 2.0. Biden couldn't be bothered. Had to be heckled into saying her name, butchered the name, then apologized for using the word illegal. That was Joe Biden. Trump went and consoled the family and talked about Lakin and what happened to her. Here is Trump earlier outside the funeral home, flanked by lots of police officers in Cut 42.
Sad event, such a horrible thing, and it's happening all too often, and we're just not going to let it happen. We just can't. 21 times arrested this thug, and they don't learn because they don't respect. They're not given the respect. The police are the greatest people we have. There's nothing and there's nobody like them, and this should never happen. I just visited with a very beautiful wife that now doesn't have her husband. Stephanie was just incredible. Their child, brand new, beautiful baby, sitting there, innocent as can be, and doesn't know how his life has been changed. But the Diller family will... You'll never be the same. You can never be the same. And we have to stop it. We have to stop it. We have to get back to law and order. We have to do a lot of things differently.
So he met with this family, with this grieving widow, that little baby. Dad is dead. Killed by a repeat felon in New York. So the wake is today and going on to tomorrow. There's a funeral coming up. Joe Biden is the current president, of course. He's also in New York. Unclear if he's going to attend any of these things for Officer Diller and follow Trump's lead. What he's there for today, tonight, is a $25 million fundraiser for his campaign at Radio City Music Hall. Barack Obama's there. The gang's all there. Tickets start in the hundreds of dollars, and then there's like special goodies if you donate $100,000 or $250,000 or $500,000. They're bringing in $25 million for the campaign in New York. Just a few miles from where this wake is taking place, but it'll be a very high-dollar, very fancy evening. Celebrities everywhere. Stephen Colbert, Lizzo in the house, Mindy Kaling, Queen Latifah, Ben Platt, the list goes on. And for a certain amount of money, Dr. Jill Biden, the First Lady, will invite you to a VIP after party. That sounds lovely. Very different itinerary for Donald Trump and Joe Biden in New York today, don't you think? Another hour coming up.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News.
Fox News.
You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a new hour on The Guy Benson Show from Washington, D.C. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free when the show is over. I'm on special report tonight on the panel in the 6 p.m. Eastern hour. Fox News Channel. Check your local listings. Tune in. Set your DVR. Hope to see you there. Fox News alert as we get rolling here in our middle hour. The Dow ending in the green again today, up 47 points, finishing up at 39,807. Well, still to come on the show, Paul Morrow will be here, as will Byron York. A lot to get to, including introducing a new member of our team here on the program. Right now, though, I want to spend some time with you reading an op-ed column, guest essay, whatever you want to call it, by a man named John Spencer at Newsweek. John Spencer is the chair of Urban Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. He served for 25 years as an infantry soldier, including two tours in Iraq. So this is a man who knows what he's talking about when it comes to urban warfare. He literally teaches the class at West Point, the chair of Urban Warfare Studies. So at Newsweek, he poses this question. Israel has created a new standard for urban warfare. Why will no one admit it? Let's listen to this expert and contrast his serious, sober analysis of reality with the insane, deranged genocide screeching that we hear from the pro-Hamas, anti-Israel brigade. I'll just read. The Israeli Defense Forces conducted an operation at Al-Shifa Hospital in the Gaza Strip to root out Hamas terrorists recently, once again taking unique precautions as it entered the facility to protect the innocent. Israeli media reported that doctors accompanied the forces to help Palestinian patients if needed. They were also reported to be carrying food, water, and medical supplies for the civilians inside the hospital. None of this meant anything to Israel's critics, of course, who immediately pounced. The critics, as usual, didn't call out Hamas for using protected facilities like hospitals for its military activity, nor did they mention the efforts of the IDF to minimize civilian casualties. In their criticism, Israel's opponents are erasing a remarkable, historic, new standard Israel has set. In my long career studying and advising on urban warfare for the U.S. military, we gave you this man's bio at the top. He chairs this area at West Point. He knows of what he speaks and writes. He says, in my long career, I have never known an army to take such measures to attend to the enemy's civilian population, especially while simultaneously combating that enemy in the very same buildings. In fact, by my analysis, Israel has implemented more precautions to prevent civilian harm than any military in history, above and beyond what international law requires, and more than the U.S. did in its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The international community, and increasingly the United States, barely acknowledges these measures while repeatedly excoriating the IDF for not doing enough to protect civilians, even as it confronts a ruthless terror organization holding its civilians hostage. Instead, the U.S. and its allies should be studying, instead of excoriating them, it should be studying how they can apply the IDF's tactics to protecting civilians. Despite the fact that these militaries would almost certainly be extremely reluctant to employ these very same techniques because of how it would disadvantage them in any fight in an urban terrorist battle against a terrorist army like Hamas. In other words, people are attacking Israel despite the extraordinary, historic, unprecedented steps Israel's taking to protect civilians. And if we said, oh, hey, guess what, critical governments, you need to go by Israel's standards in the future in your wars, those militaries would say, hell no, that's way too much of a disadvantage for us, which is telling. The story goes on. This is the piece by John Spencer. The predominant Western theory of executing wars, called maneuver warfare, seeks to shatter an enemy morally and physically with surprising, overwhelming force and speed, striking at the political and military centers of gravity so that the enemy is destroyed or surrenders quickly. This was the case in the invasions of Panama in 1989, Afghanistan 2001, Iraq 2003, and in the failed illegal attempt by Russia to take Ukraine in 2022. In all of these cases, no warning or time was given to evacuate cities, unlike what the Israelis have done. Constant warnings, constant efforts to evacuate people. In the past, Israel has actually individually called phone numbers or dropped leaflets or broadcast announcements over loudspeakers, get out of here because we're going to drop a bomb. No one else does this. Only the Israelis, and they get dumped on, regardless. In many ways, writes John Spencer, Israel has had to abandon this established playbook in order to prevent civilian harm. The IDF has telegraphed almost every move ahead of time so civilians can relocate, nearly always ceding the element of surprise. This has allowed Hamas to reposition its senior leaders and hostages as needed through the dense urban terrain of Gaza and the miles of underground tunnels it has built. Hamas fighters, who, unlike the IDF, don't wear uniforms, have also taken the opportunity to blend into civilian populations as they evacuate. The net effect is that Hamas succeeds in its strategy of creating Palestinian suffering and images of destruction to build international pressure on Israel to stop its operations, therefore ensuring Hamas's survival. Israel gave warning in some cases for weeks, for civilians to evacuate the major urban areas of northern Gaza before it launched its ground campaign in the fall. The IDF reportedly dropping over 7 million flyers. But it also deployed technologies never used elsewhere in the world, as I witnessed firsthand on a recent trip to Gaza and southern Israel. Israel has made, and I was just talking about this a moment ago, Israel has made over 70,000 direct phone calls, sent over 13 million text messages, and left over 15 million pre-recorded voicemails to notify civilians that they should leave combat areas, where they should go, and what route they should take. They deployed drones with speakers and dropped giant speakers by parachute that began broadcasting for civilians to leave combat areas once they hit the ground. They announced and conducted daily pauses of all operations to allow any civilians left in that combat area to evacuate. These measures were effective. Israel was able to evacuate upwards of 85% of the urban areas in northern Gaza before the heaviest fighting began. This is consistent with my research on urban warfare history that shows that no matter the effort, about 10% of populations tend to stay. And the story goes on with more details. This man, this expert, John Spencer, writes, of course, the true number of Gaza civilian deaths is unknown. The current Hamas-supplied estimate is over 31,000, but it does not acknowledge a single combatant death, nor deaths due to any misfiring of its own rockets or other friendly fires. So the numbers are BS. The IDF estimates it has killed about 13,000 Hamas operatives, a number I believe to be credible, partly because I believe the armed forces of a democratic American ally over a terrorist regime, but also because of the size of Hamas fighters assigned to areas that were cleared. And having observed the weapons used, the state of Hamas's tunnels and other aspects of the combat now speak for themselves. So that would mean that some, if that's true, let's say the total number is 31,000, which is what Hamas says. Let's say we believe Israel, 13,000 of them were Hamas. That would mean some 18,000 civilians have died in Gaza, a ratio of roughly one combatant to 1.5 civilians. Given Hamas's likely inflation of the death count, the real figure could be closer to 1 to 1. Either way, this is important. Either way, the number would be historically low for modern urban warfare. The UN, EU, and other sources estimate that civilians usually account for about 80% to 90% of casualties in a war zone, or a 1 combatant to 9 civilians ratio, 1 to 9 in modern war. In 2016 and 2017, the Battle of Mosul in Iraq, a battle supervised by the United States, using the world's most powerful air power and resources, some 10,000 civilians were killed, compared to roughly 4,000 ISIS terrorists. And yet, analysts who should know better now are still engaging in condemnation of the IDF based on the level of destruction that has still occurred, destruction that is unavoidable against an enemy that embeds in a vast tunnel system under civilian sites in dense urban terrain. Ironically, the careful approach Israel has taken may have actually helped, or actually has led to more destruction, because the IDF giving warnings and conducting evacuations help Hamas survive, thus prolonging the war. So Israel is doing things that modern armies and militaries have literally never done anywhere before to mitigate this problem and protect civilians, and they're being called the agents of genocide in response. The death civilian to combatant ratio is the best ever in modern warfare, and you would never know it from the hysterics. Facts matter. I'm Guy Benson. Thanks for tuning in. Yesterday, we learned that America lost a statesman, four-term U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, a longtime Democrat from Connecticut. He became an independent because he lost a Democratic primary in 2006 because he had supported the Iraq War, so the left came after him He lost the primary, ran as an independent, won re-election as an independent, and then served that fourth and final term until the new Congress of 2013 was sworn in. So he was a fixture in Washington, D.C. for quite some time. He was very close friends with Democrats and Republicans alike. Perhaps most famously, he was the running mate of Al Gore in 2000, that wild, historic, controversial election that ended up going to the Supreme Court. And in parentheses here, real quick, not to get too political, but I've seen, for example, the New York Times in their obituary to Lieberman kind of suggesting or hinting that the election was only won by Bush and Cheney in 2000 because of the Supreme Court intervening. In fact, the record is established that Bush won Florida. Indeed, if a statewide recount had taken place, because the media did it after the election, every single ballot recounted, Bush's victory margin in Florida increased by more than 1,000 votes. And the media, I think, actually depressed Republican turnout in the western part of the country by preemptively and wrongly calling the race for Gore in Florida. In any case, Gore Lieberman, that ticket lost so narrowly, officially by just over 500 votes in Florida and therefore the presidency back in 2000. Lieberman was Gore's running mate in that year. And then 8 years later, two cycles later, he was back on the stage at a major party convention, this time endorsing the Republican ticket for president in 08, McCain and Palin against Barack Obama. He was such close friends with John McCain. So in 2000, his speech, much of it was very positive, so pro-America. This man, Lieberman, was a patriot, and he said this in Cut 32 in the process of accepting his party's nomination for the vice presidency.
Is America a great country or what? Yes, it is. God bless America. Land that we love. Hadassah, even before Al Gore made me his running mate, you made me the luckiest guy in the world. I am so fortunate to have you by my side on this journey, and I thank you, sweetheart, for everything you mean to me. That miraculous journey begins here and now. Tonight, I am so proud to stand as your candidate for Vice President of the United States.
And there is that hard-fought, very closely contested election. And as I mentioned, 8 years later, at the RNC in Minnesota, Lieberman, in endorsing McCain, said this to a packed house, Cut 34.
What, after all, is a Democrat like me doing at a Republican convention like this? Well, I'll tell you what. I'm here to support John McCain because country matters more than party.
Lieberman, by that point an independent, saw Barack Obama, in my mind, for what Obama is, and decided that the country would have been in better hands with John McCain as president. I, of course, agreed, voted for McCain over Barack Obama. In 2008, Obama won. I think the country is worse off for that. But Lieberman was an unpredictable and thoughtful politician, which is something of a rarity these days. It's unusual. And he often rankled his own party. Of course, he voted as a Democrat and as generally a liberal most of the time, to the chagrin of many Republicans. But he charted his own course. He loved America. He is very strong on Israel. As a matter of fact, just 8 days ago, he published a Wall Street Journal op-ed really lambasting, politely but firmly excoriating, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, for that terrible, shocking inappropriate speech he gave on the Senate floor, basically calling for regime change in Israel, a Democratic ally, in the middle of a war that was brought to Israel by Hamas terrorists. And Lieberman wrote just over a week ago that Schumer had crossed a red line that should never be crossed again. I encourage you to go read that op-ed. He was independent and speaking his mind until the very end. And whether I agreed or disagreed, I appreciated the contributions of Joe Lieberman over the course of a lengthy and consequential political career. He apparently had a pretty serious fall just very recently, and his health deteriorated rapidly, and he died yesterday at the age of 82. U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman, rest in peace, sir. It's the Guy Benson Show.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Halfway through the Guy Benson Show on this Thursday. Thanks for tuning in. With us now, Paul Morrow, attorney, retired NYPD inspector, and a Fox News contributor. Paul, always good to have you here. Please tell us about Officer Jonathan Diller of the NYPD.
So Diller is a three-year cop. He's working in a rough area of Queens, doing a sort of community policing detail, which is the term for the unit that he was in. And they approach a car, that is, he and his partner approach a car that is parked on the street that appears to be casing a location. The car is parked there for a long time, and there was just something inexplicable about it. So they approach the car just to speak to the two occupants, and they're just not cooperative. They won't roll down the window. They won't acknowledge the police. Ultimately, when they do, their movements are furtive. Diller asks the passenger side occupant to step out. That person refuses, begins to struggle with Officer Diller when Officer Diller goes to open the car door. And ultimately, that person pulls a handgun, shoots Officer Diller, and as so often happens, and it's just heartbreaking, it just misses his vest and gets Officer Diller underneath the vest. He sustains a stomach wound and ultimately fatal. Turns out it's a career criminal, 21 priors, four heavy felonies. Driver's previously convicted of attempted murder, is on bail on a gun charge, and just two bad guys who, unfortunately, Officer Diller crossed paths with. And so we'll be waking him today, tomorrow, and the funeral is on Saturday.
Let's talk about this person who murdered this police officer. You just mentioned it in passing, but let's linger. Let's underscore. 21 prior arrests for the man who then shot and murdered an NYPD officer, including these weren't just like, you know, minor theft, shoplifting. As you said, there were some serious felonies in there. How is it possible? This is the question I think many Americans, certainly New Yorkers, are asking themselves. How is it possible that someone would be out on the street after 21 arrests to even have the opportunity to murder a cop?
You know, there seems to be an unwillingness to just recognize the fact that there are among us some incorrigibles, and they're not coming back to us. The idea that they're going to straighten their lives out and there are rehabilitation programs out there that are going to make them upstanding citizens is a canard. Is that possible? Of course it is. But once you've hit a certain point where you are a felony recidivist and you're in and out of jail, you do hit a point where you have to say to yourself, we have to lock these people up for the sake of the rest of society, just so they don't hurt other people, period, end of story. Forget all the other theories, and they are numerous, of incarceration, rehabilitation, retribution, et cetera. These are the things that scholars parse all the time. But ultimately, you come to a place, at least I have, and I know many others have as well, where it just comes down to quarantining society, not just cops, but the rest of us, civilians, anybody, store owners, away from people who just do not seem interested or capable of eschewing a life of violence and antisocial behavior. And until we recognize that there are incorrigibles among us, I don't think this is ever going to be solved. And the decarceration movement has baked this into the cake. As you and I have talked about, Rikers Island is being closed. We're going to go down 50% from the bed count, prisoner bed count we have now. And so those who just
That's crazy.
Won't walk away from that life, you know, they're going to be even more among us than they are now.
Well, and Paul, I know there were controversies out on the West Coast with, for example, a three strikes law in California. In this case, with this accused killer, and by the way, this is a young man, this police officer, a family man. It's just, it breaks your heart. It wasn't three strikes. It was 21 strikes. And then he kills a cop.
Yeah.
And by the way, the driver of this vehicle, who's a party to this crime, not the trigger man, but as you said, also someone who had a very serious record. You said attempted murder. That was a previous conviction. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then he's out on bail on a gun crime. Just explain this to me, because in my brain, I say, if you've already been put away for trying to murder someone, then you're back out in society and you are busted for any crime, let alone one with a gun. Why are you anywhere other than behind bars at that point?
So, you know, and I hate to pull this into sort of political and a sociological analysis, but ultimately that's what this redounds to. And what it really comes down to is that, as I said, we just don't want to acknowledge the fact that we have some incorrigibles, and it ultimately gets all tied up with race. And certainly after George Floyd, the left, particularly the progressive left, saw their opportunity to push through the complete wish list of criminal justice reforms that they always wanted. And if you in any way push back on that, you are immediately accused of being racist. And it's such an insult. I mean, the NYPD is majority minority and has been for like at least a decade. The entire command staff are all people of color. And it also assumes that black people don't want to be safe in their neighborhoods as well. And of course they do.
Which is insulting and racist unto itself.
Completely. And yet we can't acknowledge that, and the progressive left will never acknowledge it, because it's one of the primary mechanisms that they use. They keep that myth alive that every day police departments across this country, all white males, wake up saying, how can I shoot a black person today? It's insulting to black cops, people I worked with, black people who just want to be safe. And I think that's why you see President Biden staying away from these issues, because he is afraid of losing the black vote. But what he doesn't realize is this is one of the reasons, and I think this has been underreported, it's one of the reasons that I think he's losing the black vote, because they just see their neighborhoods and their cities deteriorating.
Yeah, no, he's worried about the activists. He's worried about the pro-Hamas people. He's worried about the anti-cop people. He played footsie with them in 2020. He was endorsing elements of defund the police, like redirecting funds. Kamala Harris's running mate went even further. This is part of their legacy. And since we have gone into the political realm, Paul, I just want to get your reaction to this. Whatever you think of former President Trump, Trump is today attending this wake for this murdered officer in New York. As it happens, the president of the United States, the current one, not the former one, Joe Biden, will also be in New York, along with Hillary Clinton, along with Barack Obama. They are doing this glitzy, massive fundraising event in Manhattan in Midtown. The cheapest ticket is hundreds of dollars. You get a photo with that trio, Biden, Obama, Hillary, for $100,000. Other people get special benefits and incentives for donations of $250,000, $500,000. This is a very high dollar event for the Democrat Party, for Biden's reelection. That's what the sitting president is up to today in New York. The former president is also in New York paying respects to a cop who was shot dead. That is a pretty striking juxtaposition in my mind.
Yeah, and I think that the electorate doesn't miss it. Certainly the police don't. Now, there's another wake tomorrow and then the funeral on Saturday. So it's possible that Joe Biden will attend. He is taking some heat on this. I think there's also the issue of his handlers curate his appearances so methodically that they may not like the fact that that is, that kind of an event, a wake with a lot of cameras and everything else, may not be perfectly choreographed for him. And as we both know, he's entirely prone to gaffes, and a gaffe at a police funeral could be fatal for him. So, I think there's probably some trepidation in that area, but you're 100% right. It just really demonstrates the paradigm. And, you know, Kamala
and
Harris.
He should be, just sorry to jump in, and I'll let you finish that thought. He's the sitting president. He will occasionally come out with some emotive statement, or the White House will highlight something that they actually really care about if they feel like it's in their political interest. They should be the ones showing leadership and taking the lead here. I'm not blaming Joe Biden for what happened to this police officer, but it is part and parcel of the job. When something horrendous happens and you're the president, you at least have to pretend to care. And you can tie some of these policies to the president's party and some of the things that he has said through the years, but you man up and you show up and you show leadership. And it seems like if he were to attend something later in the week, maybe he will, maybe he won't, Trump is the one who actually got out in front of this thing.
Yeah. And in fact, if he does show, it's the, I think, optic is going to be that he was shamed into it by Donald Trump attending.
Yeah, following Trump.
You know, following Trump. And it's just going to be a, you know, a move for votes. You know, look, he wouldn't even say Laken Riley's name because he's afraid of upsetting his progressive wing relative to the migrant situation.
Yeah, then he got heckled into it and got the name wrong.
That's right.
Then apologized for saying illegal. So, I mean, that was quite a performance.
Right, right. Yeah, the next day he has to back off of somebody who's de facto illegal. He's got Kamala putting together a police accountability database. That's really his primary initiative in the area of policing. And he, along with her being the border czar, he puts out at State of the Union, in passing, he will mention law enforcement generally to give numbers, which are completely specious, by the way, that he has used to fund law enforcement. He's been completely absentee on this issue. And it is because he's afraid of losing the progressive vote. And who keeps this alive, all of this, is primarily white liberals. Just to be clear, white urban liberals in the academy and in the media who keep these myths alive so that it can work for them. They can put the heroic hat on themselves and act like they're crusaders. And who suffers? You and I both know this. Who gets shot in this country? Young black men. What a waste of human resources, people who could contribute to society to go on and have careers in law enforcement, of course, and other things. And that's who suffers here. But
no, these activists, including white people, then they turn around, they look at their handiwork, and when more people of color are killed because of the terrible effect this has had on police, their activism, they say, well, that's just more proof of systemic racism in our country and what a rotten country we are. So it's just always self-fulfilling and self-reinforcing, and it's deeply perverse. And that's why I think it needs to be called out and opposed at every step, because it's actually dangerous. It's deadly, as a matter of fact. Paul Morrow, stand by. There are a couple other stories I want to talk to you about out of New York and Illinois. We'll get to those right after this break. It's the Guy Benson Show.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
NYPD alum and Fox News contributor Paul Morrow, kind enough to stick around with us through the break. I want to cover two more topics with you, Paul. One from New York. Have you been following this TikTok game where random women are just getting punched in the head on camera in New York City? What's going on here? Is this like a fake outrage? Is this some sort of a moral panic over a very small thing? Or is it concerning enough? And I just don't understand. Do people feel, maybe I'm answering my own question, like they could just go and assault a woman on camera in New York City, and ultimately, if they get punished at all, it won't be that severe? I mean, you got to throw the book at people if you expect things like this to stop. Anyway, I'll stop talking and let you respond.
Yeah, so, you got it right. I mean, there's just such impunity among the perps here in the city. They know, listen, one thing about the criminal element anywhere, but especially in New York City, they know the criminal justice system in some instances better than the police. They know all the ins and outs. They know the corrections system, et cetera. And it took a nanosecond for them to understand that I can kind of get away with anything. The worst that's going to happen is they're going to bring me to the precinct. They're going to make me sign some paperwork. It's a glorified summons these days unless you commit a heavy, heavy felony. And I'm going to get right out, especially in Manhattan and Alvin Bragg's jurisdiction, but really all except Staten Island, all of the other borough prosecutors, they're all of the same ilk. They're all progressive decarceration, defund types. They don't get as much media because Bragg has decided to go after Trump and Manhattan is kind of the glamour spot. But this is the paradigm, and it just is, I think, it's probably exacerbated a bit by social media. There's probably something performative to it, kids trying to get themselves followers. But what also is going on is that the air of menace and danger in the subway, it's no accident that what you're talking about is happening in the subways. We've lost the subways. They're trying to do everything they can to take them back. But the real truth of it is you're never taking it back until you do what you and I are talking about, which is lock some people up, quarantine them away from society to keep the rest of us safe.
Yep. And I've seen this story has broken through enough that even CNN was covering it earlier with a headline, multiple women say they were punched on New York City streets. And in some cases, it's not just them saying it. It's on camera because it's, I guess, a game. Assaulting women is just a fun game for certain people in New York, and they feel like they can just get away with it. And then you sort of split screen that with what's happening also in New York City, where illegal immigrants have just started getting their debit cards, courtesy of taxpayer dollars, and they just have to promise that they'll only spend that money on certain things. I'm sure, Paul, that if any of these illegal immigrants stray away from that promise on how they spend taxpayer money on their basically quasi-untraceable debit cards, there'll be serious consequences for them, right?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, sure, they'll be locked right up and deported, please. You know, look, this is an old story here in New York. I mean, I can't remember arresting a perp when I was in uniform on the street that didn't have five or six benefit cards on him. There is a whole shadow economy in New York City. The bodegas, that's the small grocery stores, they all are part of it. I'm sorry, but they just are. Now the weed shops that are everywhere, all of which are illegal, by the way, de facto illegal, but there's no enforcement mechanism. Our genius legislature put the whole thing through without considering how to enforce it. They all are part of this. You go in with that card. You're supposed to only use it for staples, bread, milk, whatever. You get 50% back in cash value. So they'll charge $100 on the card. You get $50 cash, and now you can go use that $50 however you like. Generally, before the migrants, it was primarily going to be drugs, and there's a whole economy related to that. Now with the migrant overlay, my understanding is they're using all kinds of different names. They're all getting multiple benefit cards. It's just out of control. There again are no
enforcement
mechanisms.
What an absolute joke. And these are people in the country illegally to begin with. This is what drives people crazy. Paul, we only have a little bit of time left. There's a horrible story along these same lines out of Illinois. A man was paroled. He was released onto the streets and immediately reoffended in one of the most horrible ways imaginable. Tell us about what happened in Chicago.
So this guy, Brand, what happens is he's locked up. His significant other knows that he's dangerous. She's trying to get a restraining order against him. The hearing on the restraining order is going to be on a day certain. Let's say it was the 14th. The parole board, in its wisdom, releases him on the 13th. He goes out and plays right to type and allegedly shows up at her door, attacks her with a knife, and when her 11-year-old son attempts to intervene and protect his mother, he gets stabbed in the chest, I believe, and he goes DOA. And it's just part of what you and I were talking about earlier. Look who the victims are. This is a guy who should have been in and stayed in, and at the very least, a restraining order in place. And when he – by the way, he was a career domestic abuser. She'd been up and down with this guy. And there's just such a reticence to just recognize that some people don't deserve their freedom until they either learn their lesson or they just age out because
– And now there's an 11-year-old boy dead in Illinois, completely avoidable. There has been a resignation from the parole board, at least a tiny modicum of accountability in this horrible case, but it's just been a parade of these stories. One small silver lining to some of this, coming back to the initial story, Officer Diller's widow will have her mortgage paid off in Long Island by the great people at Tunnel to Towers. I'm sure that is cold comfort to her and just a very small thing, but it will help that family. God bless Tunnel to Towers, but what an awful overall case and circumstance for that family and for the city. And I'm glad that former President Trump is going where he's going today, because someone has to shine a spotlight on this. It has to stop. Paul Morrow, attorney, retired NYPD inspector, Fox News contributor on The Guy Benson Show. Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
Final hour of The Guy Benson Show is up next. Byron York is here when we return.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour, brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It's the happy hour on the Guy Benson Show, Friday Eve. Thanks for being here. GuyBensonShow.com. That's our website. Podcast is free and on demand every day when the show is over, plus bonus Benson on the weekends. Tonight I'll be on Special Report on the panel with Brett Baier and company around 6:40 or so Eastern Time, Fox News Channel. Hope to see you there. This radio hour is sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink, which we recommend to everyone if you're 21 plus only. And we always, of course, recommend that you drink responsibly as well. TheLongDrink.com. That's their website. Find out why I'm such a fan. Find out where it's sold near you or order online. TheLongDrink.com. But with us now is Byron York, who is the chief political correspondent at the Washington Examiner and a Fox News contributor. Byron, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Guy. Thanks for having me.
All right. So a couple polls just to talk about and see how you're feeling about where the presidential race stands at this moment. For weeks, really for months, President Trump, the former president, has held a modest but consistent lead over the incumbent Joe Biden in national polling and in virtually all of the key swing states. In the last week or so, we've seen some better polls for Biden. There is one that had him up by 5 in Pennsylvania. Quinnipiac had a national poll out that had Biden up 3 overall across the country. Even with horrendously bad approval ratings, he was still leading Trump by 3 points. But then there are other polls that I saw out today. Harris had a poll that has Trump up a couple points. Fox News, our new poll, has Trump up 5, I believe, with dreadful numbers. And you look in the internal stats for Biden, like really disaster level. So when you take all of this in, and it's just a massive amount of data to ingest, where do things stand? Has the race changed at all recently, or is it kind of status quo?
No, I don't think it has. I think that some of the stuff you were citing falls under the category of wishful reporting, because some polls did show a slight uptick for Joe Biden. Maybe the I was just checking. His job approval rating went up, you know, by half a point, maybe 3/4 of a point. So the change has been very, very minor. And I think the interesting thing here, and I wrote about this yesterday, is that we may not be paying enough. We're looking at all these head-to-head matchups. We may not be paying enough to the simple job approval rating of Joe Biden. And when I wrote it yesterday, his job approval rating was 40.3% in the Real Clear Politics average of polls. I just checked now, it's 39.9%. But it has bumped around in a very small range between 40 and 45% for 3 years. It fell below 45% on October 7th, 2021, and it has never been that high again. So that kind of tells me that people have made up their minds about him. Now, they may change within, you know, weeks of the election when the whole thing is bearing down on them and they think, I've got to make a choice.
Right. They might have made up their minds that he's a bad president, but then there's a choice to be made about whether they're going to vote for him anyway. That's a separate question. But again, I think you were just about to get to some of the other polls. Also looking pretty rough for him on that front.
Yeah. You know, the one thing I thought was pretty fascinating about the Fox News poll, which came out last night, was that they, of course, like most good pollsters, they do a two-way head-to-head matchup between Trump and Biden, and then they do a five-way matchup with Trump and Biden, RFK Jr., Cornel West, and Jill Stein. So those are all the people who are likely to be on the ballot in some states, not in most, but some states. So in the head-to-head matchup, as you mentioned, Trump is leading Biden by 5 points. Relatively small lead, but outside the margin of error. In the five-way matchup, Trump is leading Biden by 5 points, the same amount, which kind of suggests that maybe people who are getting so excited about what effect will RFK Jr. have, what effect might anybody else have, if this Fox poll were correct and the election were today, might not have a whole lot of effect at all on the net difference between Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
Something that's kind of unknowable until it happens is the effect of Trump trials on this whole process.
Yeah.
And we know that the specter of the trials has been hanging over this race for months. And I think there's probably some low engagement, low information voters who think there already have been trials and he's already been convicted. right? I'm not sure there's a ton of people out there who are confusing the idea of conviction versus indictment, but when you hear enough about indictments and you see images of Trump to and from courthouses and so forth, and the media is talking like he's guilty of crimes, it might be baked in for a lot of folks, but that could change, Byron, if and when there is a sustained trial day after day where Trump has to show up in the courtroom and sit there, and he can't do anything else. And based on the timing, starting next month in New York City, this Alvin Bragg prosecution, which I think is incredibly weak and politicized, and most people do, and most legal observers, even many on the left, agree. But nevertheless, there's going to be this New York City trial of Donald Trump, which will have that story thrust into the spotlight, number one, and tie him up in court potentially week after week after week while Biden is literally free to go do whatever he wants to do out there. Do you have any sense of how this will play, or is it kind of just a guessing game right now?
Well, you've seen a lot of, you saw a lot of frustration and anger on the part of Democrats and kind of MSNBC commentators at the delays in the Trump election trial, the Jack Smith trial, the delay caused by the Supreme Court considering Trump's immunity claim. You saw a lot of frustration and anger at about this relatively small delay in the New York trial, the Alvin Bragg trial you were just discussing, which and that anger, I think, points to how invested a lot of Biden supporters are in the idea that a Trump trial will finally turn the tide in Joe Biden's favor against Donald Trump. Because if you remember way, way back a year ago, Trump had not been indicted by anybody yet. The first one was on April 4th of last year. And there was speculation, of course, that if you were indicted, I mean, who survives that? I mean, if you're running for office and you're indicted, that's pretty much the end of you. Well, obviously, that didn't happen. Trump's instead, Trump's ratings standing in the polls in the Republican race went way up. Ron DeSantis's went down. And we all know the story. The indictments for the Republican presidential race have been actually a plus for Trump. So that's over. Here we come with this trial. And the question is, will it make a lot of difference? And I do think a lot of Democrats are a little bit wary about the fact that this is the absolute weakest possible case to start off with. And they felt that in the indictment process, Bragg, remember, was the first to indict Trump as well. Democrats are saying, gee, it's too bad that Bragg got out first and is the first indictment, because the public may look at this and then conclude that the later indictments are also kind of weak and mm-hmm. and not much. And thus, Bragg could kind of like poison the well for all of the other subsequent prosecutions. Well, now we're about to see that work out in the trial as well. And I have to tell you, I don't know. We have seen polls that say some voters who would otherwise might vote for Trump say they would not vote for Trump if he were a convicted felon. And, of course, that's the purpose of the Bragg case, is to be able to call Trump a convicted felon. I mean, these are misdemeanor charges that are past the statute of limitations, but the point is to be able to call him a convicted felon.
Right, and to pretend that they're felonies, or turn them in magically into felonies.
Exactly, and is it going to have that effect on voters that we've seen in some of those polls, or have voters already kind of digested this? A guilty verdict would not have a lot of effect, and the race continues pretty much the way it has.
Byron York, you cover immigration and the border quite a lot. The border czar in this country, technically, you can be forgiven if you forgot about this, but it's Kamala Harris, the vice president. She seems to never talk about it, never do anything about it, never travel to the border. But she did just recently have a few things to say about the border crisis and about one of her favorite hobby horses, so-called root causes. And in Cut 21, she just wanted to let everyone know that actually their approach is working. Listen to this.
For the past 3 years, I have led our administration's efforts to address the root causes of migration from Northern Central America and to create what we have named the Root Causes Strategy. This work is improving lives and livelihoods in the region and addressing the factors that drive people to migrate to the United States.
Okay, so football Spike The root causes strategy, Byron, is working well, and it's improving lives and livelihoods, and it's addressing the factors that drive people to migrate to the United States. What on God's green earth is she talking about?
That, you know, it was kind of funny as you were mentioning it. She was the border czar. I was kind of thinking to myself, no, she called herself the root causes czar, even when Biden appointed her. Uh-huh. And, you know, this has been a long-term thing in immigration in which Democrats who basically don't want to stop the flow of illegal crossers across the border say, no, you can't just build a wall and you can't just arrest people and turn around and return them to Mexico. You have to address the root causes, in other words, the poverty and the crime and the bad living conditions in a number of the countries from which they came. What's kind of interesting about this is that she viewed herself as the root cause czar, dealing with the root causes in the Northern Triangle and causing people to migrate north through Mexico. Somehow they got in the southern border of Mexico all the way up to the United States. Now, as you and I know, you've been reporting, we are seeing people from all over the world coming in to across the border. I believe in the last month or maybe the last quarter, the second biggest nationality coming across the border are people from China. I mean, we're seeing, I kind of said that like Trump, China. They're coming from, you know, they're coming from Turkey, they're coming from India, they're coming from Russia, they're coming from Pakistan, they're coming from all sorts of places, and a lot of them from China. So is root causes in the Northern Triangle really going to fix this problem? Well, obviously not. And the reason they're coming from all over the world is because they know if they cross illegally into the United States, the chances are they will be allowed to stay.
They know this, that, and she can say, do not come, as she did very famously, do not come. And they came anyway, over and over again, to the tune of 10 million illegal crossings, roughly, so far. And then, I mean, she's out there beating the drum on the job that she's done on root causes. It kind of takes your breath away, as does this. Final soundbite for you, Byron. This was the president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO for short. He was on 60 Minutes. And he was making really what amount to demands of the United States government. And here's what he said. This is how 60 Minutes framed it up in cut 26.
With the ear of the White House, President López Obrador proposed his fix, that the United States commit $20 billion a year to poor countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, lift sanctions on Venezuela, end the Cuban embargo, and legalize millions of law-abiding Mexicans living in the U.S. If they don't do the things that you've said need to be done, then what?
The flow of migrants will continue.
Ah, so Byron, all the president of Mexico wants is for us to give $20 billion a year to countries in Central and Latin America. He wants us to end our sanctions and embargoes against communist countries in the region, and he wants a mass amnesty. And if those things don't happen, then guess what? The flow of migrants will continue. That takes a set of stones on this guy to make those kinds of demands of America. But what worries me, Byron, is that the crew in charge right now in this country might be rather receptive to much of that.
There is a word for this, and it's extortion. I mean, I mean, it's just absolutely astonishing. You're right to be worried about this because given that there is no infrastructure, real infrastructure like a wall, that is regularly maintained and can actually stop the flow or slow the flow across the border, our immigration enforcement, our border enforcement, depends on who's in the executive branch. I mean, it just does. It just opened up from one day to the other when Trump left office and Biden took office. And if Trump were to take office again, it could close up again. And then the pressure would be on Mexico to come up with some sort of arrangement to deal with people who are not admitted into the United States. So it's a law enforcement matter. And if you remember Barack Obama famously argued during his presidency that enforcing the law at the border is the sole authority of the president. And by the way, he wasn't going to do it. He gets to decide not to enforce the law, too. And that's just a feature of our system.
Yep. And elections have consequences. And I listened to that laundry list of what the Mexican president wants from the United States. And I think the simple answer is one word that needs no translation from Spanish to English or vice versa. No. That would be my response. I think it would be the president's response if it were Trump. You might not get that response from President Biden, something that we're keeping an eye on. Byron York here on the Guy Benson Show. It's our happy hour. Byron, as always, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Guy.
We'll be right back after this break.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
It's the Guy Benson Show. Happy hour. Very glad that you're here. Thanks for listening. So if you're a parent, small kids in earshot of the program right now, it's perhaps earmuffs time, as it was yesterday on the home stretch, talking about some of the magic around Christmas and Easter and certain characters, right? So you have time to turn this down or turn it off. Okay, there we go. Christine, since we were talking yesterday about Meghan getting, frankly, not just a little old, to still be believing in the Easter Bunny, for example, and Santa Claus at 11, we talked about it. We hashed it out on the show during the home stretch yesterday. I got a note from a listener who has a theory, which is that Meghan is a smart kid who also knows that there's a lot in it for her to believe in these mythical creatures and figures because those entities are very generous to her. So even if she kind of knows that it's not real, she is invested smartly in playing along. I think that is a very interesting theory, and I wonder what you think.
Was that signed Judgey Joyce? Because that's exactly how she feels.
It was not. It was not Judgey Joyce. It was just one of our listeners who said, maybe Meghan's on to this, but realizes there's a gravy train that she doesn't want to interrupt.
I 100% am starting to think that, because do you know what she asked us for the bunny to bring last night for Easter?
What?
A desk.
Yeah.
I'm thinking she thinks that this is like Christmas all over again. She's like, maybe the bunny could bring me this desk, and found one online that she loved. I'm like, okay, that's not what he normally brings, Meghan. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a birthday. So,
She's like, yes, Mom, but the bunny can bring me this, right? So maybe she's on to this.
I actually think that person is correct. And I am looking forward. Who did we decide that is going to break the news to her next month? Jimmy Vaila?
We were debating. Maybe Kat Timpf would be a good one.
Oh,
you keep working on that.
Yeah.
You keep working on that, but this is a working theory at the moment. I guess we'll find out. It's the Guy Benson Show. We'll be right back.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
At the top of today's program, former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo from the Trump administration joined us. We had a wide-ranging conversation. Here's part of that discussion with Secretary Pompeo. I was genuinely surprised, and I hold this administration in pretty low esteem on a number of fronts, but I was still a bit stunned by the vote this week at the United Nations. The abstention by the United States allowing this Israel-opposed, flawed, so-called ceasefire resolution to pass. The Israelis, of course, are very upset that that happened. President Biden had summoned a new delegation to Washington to discuss the Rafah question, trying to convince Israel not to do what must be done in Rafah. Now that delegation has been postponed, delayed, or just canceled because of this diplomatic flare-up, where there is now quite a lot of daylight between the Israelis and the United States of America. And the context for this, as you know, Mr. Secretary, is October 7th, this existential war, these savages in Hamas, the hostages still there, including, as you point out, Americans. I just wonder what your reaction is to Biden policy vis-a-vis Israel, what happened at the United Nations this week, and where we can go from here.
I find that policies they've chosen to be personally abhorrent, Guy, and as a policy matter, dangerous for the United States of America. So, you know, we could go through the list. You began with this week. We allowed, that is, with American consent, we demanded that Israel conduct a ceasefire without even asking for the hostages to be returned. And we put literally no burden on the terrorists, on Hamas, underwritten by Iran. So we unilaterally sided with Hamas against the nation of Israel. That is indecent. It's inconsistent with decades plus of American history with Israel. And it fits the model, frankly, from the Biden administration. They began by calling Crown Prince in the Middle East a pariah, and by de-designating the Houthis as terrorists who are now launching missiles to take out ships in the Strait. And they negotiated to put her back in a nuclear deal with the Iranians. So they've had a long history of coddling these terrorists, and you can see the results. Now, dozens of hostages held, more than hundreds of Israelis brutalized on October 7th, and no indication that Hamas or Hezbollah or the Houthis have any reason to fear the United States or Israel's retaliation, because we have not demonstrated the resolve that is necessary.
Mr. Secretary, on another front, there was an interview given by the president of Mexico to 60 Minutes. It aired just recently, and he had a lot to say. He really went off, AMLO, as they call him. And he has a series of proposals slash demands for the United States of America. I want you to just listen to Cut 26. In some ways, it's pretty breathtaking. Listen here.
With the ear of the White House, President Lopez Obrador proposed his fix, that the United States commit $20 billion a year to poor countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, lift sanctions on Venezuela, end the Cuban embargo, and legalize millions of law-abiding Mexicans living in the U.S.
If they don't do the things that you said need to be done, then what?
The flow of migrants will continue.
So the president of Mexico to our south says this massive, frankly, invasion of the United States will continue unless the United States agrees to pay $20 billion annually to certain countries, including, I'd imagine, his own, to end the sanctions on Venezuela, to end the embargo against Cuba. Those are both communist regimes, and also a mass amnesty of millions of Mexicans in the United States as well. If AMLO or anyone else came to the negotiating table or went on national television under, let's say, President Trump with those requests, what would the response be?
You know, it's hard to even countenance that some set of requests like that would be made of President Trump or our administration. The conversations were just radically different. You remember, it is AMLO who ultimately, and against his initial desires, it was AMLO who agrees to remain in Mexico. So one president, one secretary of state were able to convince the president of Mexico to allow folks who declared asylum in the United States to return to Mexico and stay there indefinitely. And with a different president, he's making these ridiculous, ludicrous demands that you just described. Look, if he presented those, we'd say, yeah, well, nice try. That's not what we're going to do. And we would begin to impose real costs on him and his government for not doing their part to ensure that we didn't have these massive number of migrants invading our country, not just Mexican migrants, but people transiting from third countries through Mexico, along with the drugs they take with them. We had a model that demonstrated that we were going to preserve our southern border sovereignty, and President Biden has clearly signaled he has no interest in doing that.
My full interview with Mike Pompeo, available online at GuyBensonShow.com. It's part of the free podcast on demand every single day, no charge. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, our home stretch today is a special one. We have a brand new member of the Guy Benson Show team. We will introduce you to him right after this.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch on the Guy Benson Show on this Thursday. Catch me on Special Report in the next hour, Fox News Channel. GuyBensonShow.com, our website here. The podcast always free. Bonus Benson on the weekends. Well, last week, we said farewell, kind of, to a dear friend here at the show, our technical producer, our engineer, Dan, who is with us for 2 years, thereabouts. And he's not going far, just down the hall. He's still very much in our world. We will interact and intersect with him a lot, but He's not going to be on the day-to-day of this show any longer, so we paid tribute to him, took our hat off to Dan and his service here at the program. Lots of exciting things in his career and his personal life. He's getting married. That's all ahead. And then I mentioned, that Dan's replacement would be brought to all of our attention and introduced to this audience sometime very soon. Now, you might recognize the name Justin because sometimes when Dan was out, Justin would fill in. Well, there is another Justin, now full-time Justin, on the Guy Benson Show who is now filling those big shoes of Dan. So, Justin, new Justin, welcome to the show, first of all. I know you've been training and getting used to this circus now for a couple of weeks, but now formally, officially, you are here. We are thrilled that you've joined the team. Just tell the audience, if you would, a little bit about yourself and your background and the route that brought you here to the Guy Benson Show.
Yeah, Guy, thanks so much. It's kind of killed me a little bit. I've been here for about a month now, seeing how everything operates. There's been some times I've wanted to jump in, so really excited to be on the show.
I thought you were going to say it's killed you. Like, there are times you want to jump out the window working with Christine.
I can't take too many shots yet. I mean, today might be the day because she's not right next to me to do that, but I'll give her a little bit of a break to start things off.
All right, that's fair. So anyway, you've wanted to hop in, and now here's your on-air debut at the show. I cut you off. Tell us about yourself.
Yes. So again, I've been here just training under Dan. He's been great. I've gotten to meet everybody, which has been awesome. But I come here from a couple of companies, actually. I was working full-time at a place called Media Village, where I've been doing a little bit of PR stuff. But my radio background is really rooted at Sirius XM, where I've been working with Mad Dog Sports Radio and a couple of the other sports channels on Sirius XM as a technical producer, board operator. This is my first job where I'm really going into an office 5 days a week working, as I've done a lot of my Sirius XM stuff from the basement of my parents' house. And now I'm working my way into New York City every day. Come from Syracuse University, graduated 4 years ago. And yeah, like I said, a Long Island kid making my way out here every day. A little bit of a switch up, but couldn't be happier to be here.
Yeah, moving on up in the world. Now you're at Fox News headquarters from the basement. That's pretty cool. Now, I just have to ask you, because one of my best friends went to Syracuse, or at least spent a few years at Syracuse, ultimately graduated from Fordham, Dan Duva. When I refer to you as a Syracuse alum, do I call you an orange? Because I know you changed the nickname. You're not an orange man. You're just an orange. Is that the new terminology?
That's right. We're going with an orange. I mean, if you want to do orange man, I'm not going to, you know, judge you for that. But it's all like the same. It's weird. That's one of the things that made working in sports so interesting, because you always had to refer to it as a singular noun instead of plural. Like, it's not like the Yankees or the Giants. No, it's the Orange. So you refer to it as an it instead of they.
Right. And you have some teams like that, like the Jazz or the Magic. The list goes on. But they took away orange men because it was too gendered. So now it's orange. It becomes a little bit harder to talk about. But you're obviously a big sports guy. You come from that world, as did Dan, by the way, with Dan Patrick. And now you're in this world of news and politics. We do a little bit of sports talk here, not a ton. But as you're making that adjustment, how's that going? Is this sort of an insane new era for you? Because our politics are not exactly super normal these days.
No, it's a complete change up for me. And I will give the Newhouse School at Syracuse a lot of credit. You couldn't advance in that program if you didn't have any type of news background. So it's not like this is my first time ever working with news, but certainly it's a huge change up from working in sports, because, you know, the conversations are a lot more serious. I mean, sports are a lot of fun and games. Obviously, there's a great discussion to be had there, but just seeing how you and Christine and Dylan handle talking about it every day, I think, is just really interesting. And I love that I'm kind of adding that to my background. And
yeah,
I guess I always tried to avoid the political talk because it seemed a little crazy. But, you know, listening to it every day, I mean, it seems like it's a little more wild than I ever remember it being. But I think that's just a testament to the climate we're in now, as opposed to, you know, me just being in it for the first time.
Yeah. And hopefully we cover the crazy in a non-crazy way. That's what we strive to do at this show. Now, speaking of, though, I have to ask you about Christine. So I don't think Syracuse, or anything really, could prepare you to work with one cookie producer, Christine. She has taken you under her wing as one of her new best friends. If you didn't know already, that's coming. Everyone's her best friend.
Oh, I know.
How is it gone? How has it been working with Christine? I know she's from home today, so you can sort of speak more freely. She's not going to come, you know, attack you physically. So you can speak your mind. Go ahead. How's that been?
Well, it's just unbelievable, some of the stories that I'm hearing about Christine. And it's like a new one every single day. I mean, earlier this week, I heard she was mugged by a mime out in Europe.
That's right.
And she's fallen off Peloton bikes. And there's a lot for her mom to judge. I guess that's why it's good to call her Judgy Joyce. But no, in all seriousness, she has been unbelievable. I mean, I feel like I learned something from her every single day. She's trusted me to really kind of take the reins of the show from the technical side. But, you know, I'm happy to be her new best friend, if that's what it is, because
her and I
are in the studio every day. And no, I think I could kind of match her energy a little bit to the point where, you know, it's okay that I'm on that level.
No, but you saying that you're excited to be her new best friend, that is, in her mind, a binding social contract. So I just, you know, a word to the wise, you might want to just back off a little bit on the enthusiasm there. I'm sure she loves to hear it. Have you heard the hot dog costume photo story yet, or has she somehow not gotten to that?
Well, no, I haven't heard that.
Oh, wow. Gosh.
Yeah, usually that's the first thing she tells someone. Like, it's something that she's supposedly so embarrassed about, but she, like, goes around showing strangers photos of herself in a hot dog costume. So maybe you two besties can have a little drink one day after work, and Christine can fill you in on that story. Do you have any – I'm sure you have many. We only have a certain amount of time left in the show here. Do you have any questions based on some of the references or anecdotes or maybe inside jokes that you've gotten wind of so far that you – maybe want some clarification about?
I don't know about inside. I mean, again, it's just like, you know, something new happens every single day. And the one thing that I want to get a nailed down story on is about Carousel. I mean, I've heard about Carousel. Christine tried to explain it to me the other day, and it was so unbelievable because she says that she purposely got herself thrown off the horse, but then proceeds to call the horse bad. I just don't understand how, like, both could be true. Because if the horse wasn't purposely throwing Christine off of it, then it shouldn't be that bad of a horse where they had to send it to the glue factory.
Yeah, it's very important.
Amish country. The Amish
country. Okay, we have to bring down her microphone here because it's important, Justin, for me to tell you the truth without her jumping in to try to spread propaganda and lies. Here's what happened, Justin, and it's a question that every new member of the team asks within usually the first week. Carousel was a pony. A wonderful, beautiful, well-behaved, happy-go-lucky pony gifted to producer Christine as a child. What child, especially what young girl, well, maybe that's stereotypical, doesn't want a pony? Well, she got one as a gift from her parents for some sort of holiday or some sort of milestone in her life. That's really irrelevant. But Christine decided that she had a burning hatred for Carousel the pony. She tried to frame Carousel for bucking her off, which didn't happen. She threw herself to the ground to try to blame the pony, which was just a manipulative lie. And when she couldn't rid herself of the pony through those manipulations, she very sadly just put a hit out on Carousel. She had Carousel murdered, probably by some connected guys in New Jersey, if you catch my drift. And Carousel ended up in what we call the big, beautiful Golden Corral in the sky, a.k.a. a garbage dump in Staten Island. That's what happened to Carousel. Christine murdered a pony, and it's deeply disturbing. So that's the Carousel story. And we bring it up here just because, you know, I believe in justice. And I'm not just going to allow anyone, even a quote-unquote best friend of mine, get away with impunity of pony murder. And so that's the truth. That's the full story. She'll try to deny it. She'll try to tell you that she's not, for example, a Soviet-trained operative slash competitive aerobics champion. That's a whole nother thing we can delve into a different time. She will try to gaslight you and revise history, but you can trust me as the host of this show to give it to you straight. And that's the reality. Christina, I'd let you respond, but I'm afraid we're fresh out of time. Just look at the clock. We're done. Sorry. And she's going on vacation. One of her, oh my gosh, that's the other thing. I know you're just starting here, Justin, but she's on vacation constantly. All she does, I'm surprised that she like even technically still works here. Next week, she's gone the whole week. Very typical. So she can maybe respond.
I guess I have the whole studio without her then. That's a real shame.
You do, certainly for this coming week, next week. So maybe she can respond and try to poison the well and muddy the waters when she comes back from one of these many vacations. But I think that I've given you an important, if distressing, education into the background of producer Christine. And just welcome to the show. You're now fully, very much in the fold. You've been baptized into the Guy Benson Show inner circle, and we are very glad for that initiation. In all seriousness, welcome. We are really, truly grateful that you're here, and we look forward to working together for quite some time.
Yes, Guy, I couldn't be happier to be here. I can't wait to, you know, chat it up with you about all things sports, to kind of mess with Christine a little bit. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm very excited to be part of the team.
I'm on special report on the news channel coming up here in the next hour. Back here, same time, same place, for the Friday edition of the Guy Benson Show tomorrow. We will talk to you then.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.